2012, February 20th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 31, The Properties of Stars. The first lecture in Unit 5, Life in the Universe. So, with this new unit, this week we're going to be looking, we'll call it sort of a miniature Astronomy 162. We're going to be looking at, very quickly, the properties of stars, the lives of stars, what our solar neighborhood looks like. What's the population around us in the galaxy? And then we're going to redefine the habitable zone and use that as our starting point for understanding what we're, where we should be looking for possible habitable planets, and then go into a summary of the search, very successful for the last 20 years, for finding planets around other stars. As I've mentioned at various times before, when I first started teaching at Ohio State, we knew of exactly one solar system, ours. We now know, I forget what the census is, it changes every day, but it's more than 700 or close to 800 planetary systems now around other stars. Some of them are actually multiples, and some of them are quite spectacular multiples coming out of the Kepler mission. So we'll be talking about that over the next week. And then we're going to head out in a somewhat wilder and woollier territory. We'll start talking about what do we mean by intelligent life, which, of course, is really what motivates a lot of this, for not just simply finding bacteria, but actually finding someone else we could possibly talk to. So we'll be looking at things like the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, the question of how you would actually go about interstellar travel, interstellar colonization, and really get at this question, are we alone in the universe? How would we go about telling, and what are the chances for finding life elsewhere? So in many ways, we kind of saved the best for last in this course. So we'll be working our way through that over the next 3 weeks. But today, we have to step back and do some basic astronomy. And today is going to be a discussion of the basic properties of stars. So there's a lot to go through here. This is a very abbreviated version of what we would go through in Astronomy 162, where we'd spend a whole section on this. But today we're just going to go over the highlights that are important to us for understanding how we focus our search on the many billions of stars in our galaxies. We're going to look at just the basic physical properties of stars. The fact that a star's color, whether it's red or blue, tells us something about its temperature. Cool stars are red, hot stars are blue, and of course a range of colors in between. The other stellar property that will concern us is the star's luminosity, its total power output. That's going to be of relevance for understanding where around that star, what, if any, of a habitable zone it might have. And so we'll talk about the things that it depends upon. The other way is how we classify stars. We use the spectra of stars, breaking the light up into their component colors, to look at what we see for an absorption line spectra from stars shows that there's a very distinct sequence of called the spectral sequence, which allows us to classify stars by their spectral appearance. This is very useful to us because it allows us to sort stars into different classes. The classes have names, OBAFGKM, with two modern classifications, LT. We'll see a little bit about how that sequence works. This is going to identify the type of stars we should be looking for as likely places for life. Finally, we're going to introduce one of the most useful diagrams that we're going to see over and over again for the next few days, the so-called Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. It's a plot of the luminosity of a star as a function of its apparent surface temperature. We're going to see that, in fact, stars do not have any luminosity and temperature, but fall on very specific loci in this Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. We're going to see dwarf stars, giant stars, and supergiant stars. What those mean in terms of the actual structure of the star will be the subject of the next couple of lectures after this. But the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram is one of our tools for, again, sorting through the hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy and knowing how to narrow our search for where we should be looking for possible other harbors for life in our galaxy. Well, let's start with sort of a basic principle. Stars are pretty much other suns. They are hot, dense balls of gas that are self-luminous. The output spectrum from these stars is approximately what we call a black body. They approximate, to greater or lesser degrees, an object which is emitting light at all wavelengths that scales with temperature. And there are two things that happen with the changing the temperature of the surface, the outer layers of the atmosphere of these dense gas balls. The first is that you change the color of the star, whether it's red or kind of a whitish yellow or blue, depends upon the stellar temperature. The second thing that the stellar temperature combined with the size of the star changes is the total power output or the luminosity. And it's those two properties, the temperature of a star and its luminosity, that are going to be key to understanding what the appearance of the star is, because they lead to an understanding of the ultimate property we care about, the star's mass. And that will be sort of coming up here in a second. So the first of these is to simply talk about how the temperature of a star affects its gross spectral appearance. And it works pretty much in the direction you'd expect. Very hot stars will appear blue. And by hot, what I mean for a hot star is a surface temperature between 10 and 50,000 degrees Kelvin. Medium hot stars appear kind of a whitish shade of yellow. This has got kind of orangish tinges. I've done my best to do a computer representation of the color of a medium hot star like the sun. This is a temperature of about 6,000, so it's got a very slight orangish tinge, but computer projectors really don't do a great job. If you look at reflected sunlight, never look at the sun, of course, that'd be stupid. The sun looks sort of slightly yellow. Now, little kids, of course, always want to draw the sun with the brightest yellow crayon you've got. The color of the sun is not that pure. It's really kind of an off-whitish color with slightly yellowish tinge to it. Sun's temperature is about 5,500 degrees Kelvin in round numbers. Actually, it's 5,885, to be more precise. Very cool stars with temperatures around 3,000 degrees, as I've represented here, get kind of an orangish red appearance. They never appear red, kind of, you know, scarlet red in color, with very rare exceptions. There's a really strange class of stars called carbon stars that only appear red because there's very, very strong absorption lines in their spectra that gives you a very narrow range of colors. So when I talk about a red star, what we really mean is kind of this reddish shade of orange here. And the reason for that is that stars emit a very, very broad spectrum. That's what a black body is. It's a very broad spectrum that emits at all wavelengths, but the peak of that wavelength slides around with total temperature. For this class, it's basically sufficient to understand the basic qualitative outline. We're not going to go into detail about, you know, like Wien's law and Stefan-Boltzmann law in this class, because we really don't need that. We're not going to do those kinds of calculations here. So here's an example. This is a photograph of the night sky. One of the problems with seeing color in stars has to do with the physiology of the human eye. We have rods and cone cells in our eye. One of them is sensitive to color. The other is not. I always forget which one, and it's really not important. But basically, your night vision is those cells in your eye that are most sensitive to light are not sensitive to color to a first approximation. So actually, the old saying that all cats are gray in the dark is somewhat of a statement about the fact that in great darkness, human night vision is almost black and white. Not quite. There's a little bit of color sensing. But the colors have to be extreme to stand out in contrast in the darkness. And so if we take a photograph of the sky, most stars appear kind of whitish. Stars like Betelgeuse, this constellation of Orion, is one of those handful of stars that actually looks red to the naked eye. Aldebaran, Arcturus are other examples of that, and the planet Mars, but of course that's not self-luminous just because of its rusty color. So this is a very cool star. In fact, it's a cool supergiant star. And a handful of stars appear blue. So in Orion, Betelgeuse looks red. The star at the foot of Orion, the big bright star, Rigel, appears blue to the eye. But most other stars appear pretty much white. So only if they're extreme color do you see that. This photograph is necessary to pull up the bluish color of the rest of the stars, for example, in Orion's belt. But to the naked eye, the appearance of star colors is really quite difficult to see. So that's the first property, the color. And the color is related to its temperature. If it's red, it emits mostly red and infrared wavelength. If it's blue, it's emitting mostly a blue to ultraviolet wavelengths. We'll come back to that a little later. The other property of a star is the total power that it's putting out. This is like the little, you know, 100-watt label on the top of a light bulb telling you how much power is going to come out of that light bulb. Stars do the same thing. This power is measured in units of watts, which is actually a metric unit. It's a joule per second. Or sometimes, because the number of watts coming out of a star can be so large, our sun is this very big number, about 3.5 times 10 to the 26 watts. Since all stars can be seen as multiples of the sun, either dimmer or brighter than the sun, we will rescale the luminosity scale for stars to put it in terms of the luminosity of the present-day sun. It's a little dangerous to set your scale based on something which we know changes in brightness over its lifetime. But that change is really slow. And certainly on human lifetimes, and even on the plausible scale of human civilization, the sun is not going to change appreciably in brightness. So we'll define this unit called one solar luminosity, which is going to be defined as 3.486 times 10 to the 26 watts. Bear in mind, the luminosity of the true sun may be different than 1.00 solar luminosities. It certainly was dimmer in the past, and it will be brighter in the future. The range of stellar luminosities that we see among stars in the sky is really big. It ranges over a factor of 10 to the 10. It's 10 billion. From about 10 to the minus 4 times the luminosity of the sun up to a million times the luminosity of the sun for the very brightest stars in the sky. So we're dealing with something with a great big but dynamic range. The problem of stellar luminosity, however, is we only see how bright the star appears to our eye or to our instruments on Earth, because it lives at some distance away from us. So we only measure what's called an apparent brightness. And I'm going to call that apparent brightness B. If you dig into your book, you'll often see this referred to as flux. That's the technical phrase for what apparent brightness is. It's the amount of energy per unit area per second which is streaming into your eye or your telescope. So it's a much more quantitative measure. But I'm going to define this basically as B as brightness. I'm meaning apparent brightness, how bright it looks to us. That's going to be its luminosity, its intrinsic brightness, how bright it really is, the total number of watts streaming off its surface, divided by 4 pi times the distance squared it is from us. The further I get from a star, the fainter its apparent brightness. This has two consequences for us. First of all, if I see a star in the sky and I know nothing else about it, I cannot distinguish a dim star with very little light coming from it from a very, very luminous star that might be one of the most luminous stars in the universe, because I don't know how far away it is. It's either a dim star really close or a super luminous star very, very far away. Without knowing the distance, I do not know what its intrinsic luminosity is. This is what I measure. This is the observable. The other consequence this has, and we've seen this before when we talked about habitable zones, is this apparent brightness is a measurement of how much power from the star is received at the location of the planet. And so the distance here becomes the distance of the planet from its parent star. Planets that are further away from their parent star will see a smaller brightness, less stellar radiation illuminating their surfaces. Planets that are closer will see very high stellar brightness. This luminosity can be viewed in any instantaneous as essentially a constant in the problem. But we can also ask how the luminosity changes with time as stars age. And that's going to turn out to be different for different types of stars, as we're going to discuss over the next couple of lectures. So these are the part of the properties we would like to know. We'd like to have a way to measure them. Stellar luminosity is relatively straightforward to measure. You measure the brightness with a telescope, and then you have some estimate of the star's distance from us. And you put them into the formula, and you solve for the luminosity. We're not going to concern ourselves in this class with the various methods for measuring stellar brightness or measuring distance. We are going to take it as given that this is a possible operation. And in fact, it is. Distances are hard to measure, but we can do it. So we're just going to take the results in this class. If this was Astro 162, we'd be actually talking about what those methods were, and it would actually occupy a couple of lectures. So let's look at how we actually make some accurate determinations of the surface temperature of a star. That's a bit of a trick, right? We can't walk up to it and punch a thermometer into it. We have to use the properties of the light that are coming off of that star to give us a clue as to what's going on with what the temperature is inside that stellar atmosphere. And the way we do this is by measuring the spectrum of the star. We take the light, we pass it through a prism or grating, and we divide what looks to us like red light or blue light or even the sort of yellow-white light from the sun, and we break it down into its component colors and look at how those component colors are distributed, and that tells us something about the light source. Here's a series of spectra, but these are now from everyday sources rather than stars before we go diving into stars. The human eye can see from roughly 4,000 nanometers wavelength to 700 nanometers in the red, so this runs through the range of colors: red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. Off the bottom, below 4,000 angstroms, is the ultraviolet that the eye is blind to. And depending upon the person, about 700 nanometers and above goes into the infrared. This is a typical range for a person. Everyone's slightly different. My eye is actually a little bit less blue sensitive than most, but I've got pretty good red sensitivity, and I've got colleagues who have exactly the opposite of that. We figured this out by looking through different colored glasses at light sources and seeing who can see through the filter or not. So here are some standard light sources. For example, the noonday sunlight has this spectrum here. Noonday sunlight looks kind of like white light, but it's kind of skewed towards kind of these yellow-red colors here. Falls off towards the ultraviolet, falls off towards the infrared. A tungsten lamp, a typical incandescent lamp, and there's one shining in the back of the room there, although these are now all compact fluorescents for the most part. But a typical tungsten lamp, which is soon to be no longer made much, are very, very red in color. But they look kind of white to the eye, but there's a certain warmth to a tungsten lamp. That's the eye kind of picking up and sensing the red. Light-emitting diodes. A lot of light-emitting diode lamps now show up, light-emitting flashlights. You'll notice they have a sort of, the so-called white light LEDs are actually kind of bluish, and that's because they actually are made up of multiple LEDs that kind of combine together to make kind of a red-green-blue to mimic white, but they have an over-amp the blue a little bit. That's why white light LEDs have kind of this blue, frosty glow to them, and that's what their spectrum looks like. They got a peak in the blue, and then kind of this sort of greenish yellow, and then kind of red and falling off. The human eye, combining red, green, blue, makes a kind of a white. That's how this white is being made on the screen right now. There's three lamps in there, three screens, going through red, green, and blue filters, and it tricks the eye into seeing if it's white. If I was to take a little prism down here and hold it up on the screen, you'd see it break up into red, green, and blue colors under each one of these. The mercury vapor lamps, like these dim lamps up here, or these compact fluorescents, actually are very, very sharp emission lines, but they're at red, green, and blue. What really happens is there's an ultraviolet line that occurs in mercury, and then the inside of the tube is painted with an organic dye, three of them, called a tricolor phosphor, or a triphosphor paint, which glows at red, green, and blue to trick your eye into thinking it's white. They also add a little bit of extra red dye nowadays to give them a slightly warmer appearance, so you're more likely to buy those for your house than the old tungsten, inefficient tungsten incandescent lamps. And then finally, lasers have super sharp spectra. They're essentially monochromatic. So my green laser pointer is a very, very sharp monochromatic color of green. A red laser pointer would be out here. Very, very sharp color. So this is a characteristic of a spectrum. So the spectrum is looking at the amount of flux that comes out as a function of the wavelength of the light. These are everyday things. What if we apply this idea of spectroscopy to stars? What do we get? Well, what we get, if we look at a typical star, and this in fact is a spectrum of the star Vega, it's a bright blue-white star that appears in the summer sky. It's in the constellation of Lyra, the harp. And what we would see is we see a bright continuous spectrum, which is kind of peaky in the blue. So now I put this in units of, well, this unfortunately is units of angstroms, but it's 400, 500, 600, 700 nanometers. So it goes a little bit beyond human vision on both the red and the violet ends. This is a star that looks kind of bluish white to the eye, especially through a telescope. And sure enough, the light peaks out at kind of blue wavelengths and falls off towards the red. This is an indicator of a very hot spectrum. In fact, I know this particular star has a surface temperature of 10,000 degrees Kelvin. But it's not a continuous rainbow wash of color. The colors are broken up by these very black absorption lines. In this particular case, the absorption lines are due to atomic hydrogen in the atmosphere of the star. If I made the star a little bit cooler, I would see different lines come in from metals. If I made it very hot, I would see the hydrogen lines begin to vanish and lines of helium begin to emerge. The reason for that is the stars are mostly hydrogen and helium with mixtures of metals. But which lines I actually see in absorption in the star depends upon the temperature of the gas. It's for those of you who've studied any kind of a spectroscopy, it's the state of excitation of the gas. So the absorption lines, the continuum, gives us the sensation of color. This would be a blue star, a very red star, very cool star would peak up in red wavelengths. And the sun would be kind of intermediate in shape, as we saw in that previous plot. But they also have this fine detail. In addition to the gross color, blue through red with kind of yellowish white, there is also this effect of absorption lines. And the absorption lines change with the temperature of the gases that make up the outer layers of that star. And it's those absorption lines, more than that color, that actually gives us a much better quantitative handle on what the temperature of a star actually is. This is a very old technique. In fact, the technique for spectrally classifying stars by the appearance of these different dark absorption lines crossing an otherwise continuous rainbow wash of color in its spectrum is called spectral classification. The person who really pioneered spectral classification back in 1901 was Annie Jump Cannon, who was working at the Harvard College Observatory. Originally, her advisor in this work had developed a scheme for typing the stars by the different appearances of the spectra. Now, bear in mind, this is 1901. Spectroscopy was a fairly old technique. We saw it a little bit when we talked about chemistry. It was used by chemists to measure what the composition of things were in the laboratory. It was only in kind of the late 1880s, 1890s, that the techniques of photographic spectroscopy got sensitive enough to use with faint stars on telescopes. So Harvard College Observatory was one of those places taking photographic spectra of stars. However, in 1901, when Annie Jump Cannon was doing most of her work, understanding atomic theory was still 30 years in the future. They didn't understand why spectra were the way they were. It was a purely empirical exercise. So what they did was they simply put photographs next to each other and kind of noticed there were similarities and differences, and noticed that different lines would kind of get stronger and weaker kind of in a sequence. And you put them together, they would kind of come up with different types. Now, the first person who did it looked at the hydrogen lines, because they could recognize those from on the ground using hydrogen gas in a typical chemical spectrum, like in the laboratory, like chemists use. So they said, okay, we're going to classify stars where A has the strongest hydrogen lines, B has the second strongest lines, C has the next strongest lines as the hydrogen lines got weaker. So there was type A, type B, type C, type D, following the alphabet down. And then when they ran out of kind of alphabet, they started saying, well, Q is going to be kind of this kind of wacky star, and maybe P is going to be a star with this particular type of weird spectral feature. So they started using the rest of the alphabet after hydrogen had faded out completely for other stuff. That didn't work so good because there were all kinds of different properties for stars that were classified as A, different properties for stars classified as B. They really wasn't sure that C, D, and E were really that good of a classification, but F seemed to be pretty secure. And it was Cannon who said, you know, guys, and it really was guys, you're missing the pattern here. She'd looked at so many hundreds of these things following Pickering's ABC catalog. She said, you know, Pickering's ABC order is completely arbitrary. She recognized subtle patterns in the spectral lines, and she reordered the ABC classification into O, B, A, F, G, K, and M, throwing out all these redundant classes that really weren't necessary. So getting a huge classification boiled down to just seven classes, O, B, A, F, G, K, M. Now, later work has added two more types here in the last 20 years, L and T types. But this was a great leap because, in fact, this O, B, A, F, G, K, M here was not just simply a pattern of spectral lines. What Cannon had actually discerned was that it was also a patterning, it was a sequence of spectral temperature, of stellar temperature. So if I now take the spectra. Now, the spectra that Cannon was working with were on glass plates, and they were kind of like this spectrum here. These were black and white photographs, so there was no color photography possible in the early 20th century. So she was working just with these patternings of brightness at one side or another. But if I do a modern reconstruction of these spectra, and now I add color to guide the eye, this is what you get. So here's types O, B, A, F, G, K, and M. Now, later on, they found there were subtle gradations among the letters, and so they added a number, 0 through 9, for 10 subtypes within each letter type. Ignore that for this. That's what it's there for. So what you see, for example, it's kind of hard to see this. Dark line that you see over here in the red, that's a line of hydrogen. This is also a line of hydrogen here. This is the line of hydrogen that's visible at visible wave called the hydrogen beta line. That's the hydrogen alpha line. This is a sodium line. There's some lines of magnesium in here. There's another hydrogen line here called the hydrogen gamma line and so forth. And what you can see is O stars, the hydrogen lines are relatively weak. They get stronger through B, peaking in A. Remember, A stars were the original strongest hydrogen lines. And then lines begin to fade again. So here's a weak line hydrogen star, but has virtually no other lines in the spectrum. Some of the faint lines you see in there are due to helium. Here's also a star down here. These two here at F and G are also faint hydrogen lines, but there's lots and lots of other lines that do not appear in the O stars. Those are metal lines coming up as the star gets cooler. You'll notice in the colors, these stars go from very blue diagonally down to very red. So you can see the colors kind of washing to be mostly blue at the top, mostly red, with very little blue at the bottom. This is a temperature sequence. So the O stars are the hottest stars, and the M stars are the coolest stars. And so the patterning of spectral lines that N.A. Jump Cannon had discerned from looking at hundreds and hundreds of photographic spectra was basically she had discerned a change in the stellar temperature. That change in stellar temperature changes the excitation properties of the gas, and that excitation properties of the gas tell you what absorption lines appear. Here's the secret. Absorption lines in a spectrum, to a first approximation, trace excitation, not the composition. These are stars of nearly the same composition. But here's a star that looks like its atmosphere is mostly molecules. Here's a star that looks like mostly hydrogen. Here looks like hydrogen helium. If you interpreted the spectrum the way a chemist does, by saying what lines are present tells you the composition, you would make the mistake of thinking that these were all metal stars. They're not. They're mostly hydrogen helium. Because it's not just composition, it's the excitation. And the excitation is determined by, first and foremost, the temperature. So the spectral sequence is really a proxy for measuring the temperature. So here's how it works. This is the way we're going to deal with it in this class. The spectral sequence is OBAFGKM, and I'm going to add L, which are the lowest mass still stars. There's a T class, but those turn out to be substellar. They run from very blue and very hot. So we go from the hottest stars, the O stars, are 50,000 degrees Kelvin. The very coolest stars that are still stars are down around 1,300 degrees Kelvin, and those are the extreme L-type stars. Everything else is an even pattern. As I go OBAFGKML, I'm going to progressively cooler stars. I also go to progressively redder colors as I go from hot to cool. So the brightest O stars are going to be blue. The coolest M and L dwarfs really do look like sort of reddish and ruddy in color. Now, to the limitations of how well our poor projector in this room can actually do. I think this one's a Panasonic, so it does better. This is actually a computer reconstruction using a program I wrote to reconstruct as best I can the actual naked eye colors of these stars. You'll notice that while we think of blue and red, the colors are very subtle. But you'll notice, for example, no stars are green, right? The usual range of colors is Roy G. Biv, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. But you'll see how it's really kind of deep blue, they're kind of whitish, and then the whitish gets kind of tinged with red, and M stars actually look kind of orange, and L stars look like a deep orange. Sort of, you know, navel orange to blood orange going on here. What's happening is we have a very broad spectrum, and that broad spectrum tends to wipe out the primary colors, and so you're seeing these things smearing from one to the other. So if you were orbiting an O star, it would have a really neat, deep blue color. There'd be a bluish cast to everything. There was one science fiction movie, really bad but funny in its place. What the hell was it called? Deep Black. It was set on a planet with a whole bunch of stars, one of which was an O-type star. And everything had a kind of a blue tinge the way they filmed it. So that was actually, I kind of liked that part of the movie. Otherwise, it was kind of a silly Vin Diesel movie because, wow, they really got what the appearance would look like on the surface of a star illuminated by like an O or B star. That was actually pretty good. Of course, it had been roasted by UV within a few minutes, so, you know, you got to suspend your belief somewhere. So this is the deal with the OB stars. The colors are very subtle to the human eye, so we really can't use the gross color to measure temperature very accurately. It's only a gross estimate because of the way the spectra work. So we've got to take a detailed spectrum. We've actually got to see what absorption lines are present and classify the star to get a much more fine-grained measurement of temperature. So the spectrum you measure depends upon the state of ionization and excitation gas, and that depends primarily on temperature. It doesn't depend on composition. In fact, for most stars that we're going to be talking about in this class, the composition is all about the same. It's mostly hydrogen, helium, kind of 75% helium, 75% hydrogen, 24% helium, and kind of 1% everything else. But then everything else kind of matters to us because that everything else includes carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, which are the principal elements of life. So a certain quick summary of the stellar properties that interest us is they have a range of properties. Now, I haven't talked about how some of these are measured. We're going to take them as given for this class. There's a range of stellar luminosities we've already measured, from being 1/10,000th the luminosity of our sun to 1,000,000 times the luminosity of the sun. So the range of luminosity is huge, about a range of about 10 billion. The range of stellar temperatures is actually quite modest. In round numbers, it ranges from about 20,000 degrees up to a little over 50,000 degrees. Stars much hotter than this are relatively rarer. So the most of the stars that we're interested in actually are cooler than our sun, as it's going to turn out. But it's a pretty modest range. It's only about a factor of 20 or 30 in total temperature. So it's not a big change. And remember, total temperature is a measure of total energy content, or at least energy content leaking out the surface. The range of stellar radii, how big the stars are in terms of their volume, also has a fairly large range. They range down in size to about 1/100th the size of the sun for the smallest stars, the so-called white dwarfs, up to about 1,000 times the radius of our sun. So things that actually would swell up to the point that they kind of would fill up to about the orbit of Jupiter if we plopped them down in our solar system. And there turns out to be a fairly wide range of the masses of the star, the total number of kilos inside that star. Again, we're going to scale everything to the sun for convenience. And it ranges down from the smallest thing that we actually consider an honest bona fide star is about 8% the mass of the sun. The most massive stars we see around us in the Milky Way are up to about 50 times the mass of the sun, with a very, very few rare stars. And you literally can count them on your hand and still have a couple fingers left to gesture with after you're done, which have masses up to about 100 times the mass of the sun or greater. So very, very massive stars are exceedingly rare. Most of the stars we find around us are actually smaller than the sun, and we'll see that more in a coming lecture. So this is the range of stellar properties. It's this range of stellar luminosities and the range of stellar temperatures that are going to be of some interest to us. Now, it turns out that stars don't just have any old temperature, luminosity, mass, and radius. There actually are some very discernible patterns among these that give us some insights into the star. The way we see this is something called the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, in which we plot the luminosity of a star along the vertical axis and the temperature of the star along the horizontal axis. Now, I've plotted here as a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram in an observational way, in which I'm using, instead of the actual measurement of the surface temperature, I'm using a measurement of color. There actually are some fine-grained colors you can measure that can be used as a proxy for temperature along here. And then this is brightness in terms of a brightness scale, which is measured relative to nearby stars. What you see is this diagram is not just a scattered wash of points, but there are very, very strong distinctive loci. There's this diagonal band that runs from very hot, very luminous stars on the upper left-hand corner to very faint, very dim, very cool stars in the lower right. And then there's this other clump over here and this sort of broad horizontal sequence running down over here. This was, again, seen in the beginning of the 20th century by two astronomers, the Danish astronomer Einar Hertzsprung and the American astronomer at Princeton, Henry Norris Russell. This diagram is not simply a pretty plot of data points. It actually turned out to be absolutely key to understanding the physics of stars in the 20th century. We went from knowing nothing more about stars except that they were hot points of light like our sun, hot dense balls of gas, to fully understanding most of the life cycle of stars by the present day through the work of people like this. And the key to unlocking that physics was the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. Again, we're going to take for this class the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram as given. But over the next couple of lectures, we're going to develop about why stars are the way they are and where they land on the HR diagram is important. So let's start by breaking down the diagram into these different regions that clearly delineate themselves in this temperature luminosity space. The first of these is that diagonal band that runs from very bright, very, very hot stars in the upper left-hand corner to very dim, low luminosity, cool stars in the lower right-hand corner. Because it runs across the diagram and because most stars lie inside of that nearby, it's called, somewhat unimaginatively, the main sequence of stars. So if a star's luminosity and temperature lands itself here along the main sequence. We refer to it as a main sequence star. If we do a census of nearby stars, and nearby stars is going to mean a circle, a sphere around us, roughly out to about 300 light years, which is where this data are taken from, then 85% of the stars within that 300 light year circle or sphere around us are going to land right on top of the so-called main sequence. In fact, the data points are so crowded together they all blur in this plot. The Sun is a main sequence star. In fact, the Sun is right there at that little red circle. I put down one solar luminosity and the stellar temperature. So the range of properties represented by the main sequence is really wide. The luminosities range from 1% the luminosity of the Sun up to a million times the luminosity of the Sun. That's 8 orders of magnitude in brightness. The temperatures run the entire gamut from 2,000 degrees at the L dwarfs up to 50,000 degrees at the M giants. And finally, the radii run over a somewhat more modest range from about a tenth the radius of the Sun down at the coolest stars up to about 10 times the radius of the Sun somewhere in the middle here. The brightest, hottest stars are not necessarily the largest. There's actually some complicated physics that goes on to play that game. So the bottom line here is most stars seem to spend most of their time on the main sequence. Remember, when we look at the properties of stars, we're taking a snapshot of what can be a multi-million or multi-billion-year life cycle. The Sun, we've already mentioned, is about a middle-aged star, about 4.5 billion years old, and it's sitting right smack in the middle of the main sequence. So the Sun is a main sequence star now. This is going to be important because it's going to turn out that stars are going to spend, the fact that there's 85% of them, on average, stars spend 90% of their life on or near the main sequence in this diagram. And so it turns out that if we're looking for a stable place to find planets, the most likely place to find them where it's stable enough, long enough for life, is going to be somewhere along this main sequence. So this is delineating part of the hunting ground for life in the universe. These are the long-lived, relatively long-lived stable stars. Although there's some details we have to fill in, which we'll do in a subsequent lecture. Today we're just going to get the big picture. Now what about off the main sequence? Well, there are two basic groups. This one branch that seems, if you think of the main sequence as kind of a diagonal trunk in this diagram, there's one really obvious branch that comes off that turn out to be a group of stars called the giant stars. These are stars that are much more luminous for their temperature. Remember, temperature runs down here from hot to cool. Luminosity runs from dim to bright, increasing upwards. So these are stars that have the same temperature as these cool main sequence stars, but they're much brighter. To be that much brighter for that temperature means they have to be physically much larger. And so we refer to these as giant stars. And they really are giants. They range in radii from 10 to 100 times the radius of the Sun. Remember, along the main sequence, stars ran from a tenth to 10 radii of the Sun. So these are stars that are much bigger than any main sequence star, and their luminosities are really concomitantly bright. They range in brightness up in the big zone here, anywhere from 1,000 to 100,000 times the luminosity of the Sun. There's a further group, and these turn out to be fairly rare nearby, but if I do a census of the entire galaxy, I begin to fill in a group of stars at the very top of this diagram here that are cool but extremely luminous. They're even bigger, and so they're given the somewhat unimaginative name, since we've already used giants, of supergiants. Supergiants are more than 1,000 times the radius of the Sun in size. These would really fill out to the orbit of Jupiter, and they end up with the highest luminosities, about 100,000 to a million times the luminosity of the Sun. So there's blue stars up here, which are actually kind of small. In fact, they're often referred to as blue. They're actually dwarf stars by comparison. And then as they move into this part of the diagram, they swell up and puff up into these supergiant stars. And yes, someone might ask, there is in fact a hypergiant class of extremely rare stars. You can count the number of those in the Milky Way probably on both hands and still have a few fingers left to gesture towards Michigan with. Which gives you, yeah, this is about 8. And I'll let you figure out which fingers are left. So here's the HR diagram. These are the giants and supergiants. There's very few of the supergiants, which tells us they don't spend much time there. The giants, maybe about a tenth of local stars are in these giants, which tells you in somewhat of round numbers that stars spend about 10% of whatever their lifetime is among that giant class. And we're going to see this is related to the life cycle of stars. So this may not be a great place to go looking for life, planets harboring life. There's a final group of stars on here. Some of you may notice these little stars down here that are dim but really hot, and they're hanging out at the lowest luminosities. Well, let's circle those. Those have a name. If they're going to be hot but putting out very little light, they have to be really tiny. So tiny, they're referred to as the white dwarfs. White because they are literally white hot. Okay, they're actually slightly purple in color, but they were named in the days before people figured that one out. But they're really tiny. A typical white dwarf is only the radius of the Earth. It has the mass of a star, but the radius of the Earth. These are really, really strange objects. To be that hot and that dim, they have to be really tiny. In fact, the size of the Earth. But they have the masses of stars. A half a solar mass, maybe up to almost 1.5 times the mass of the Sun. Which means the material is really compressed, really compact, really tight together. To use the typical grade school astronomy 101 book description of the matter inside of a white dwarf, one teaspoon of that material would weigh as much as an elephant. It's not quite right, but it gives you the idea. It's super dense. It's denser than any material we know of on the Earth. So they have the main sequence where most of the stars are, and the Sun is a main sequence star. We have the giants and supergiants, and we have these dim white dwarfs. So this is a slightly colorized version of that same plot, and I apologize for the appearance of this in your notes, because in the black and white icing of your notes, it didn't work so good. And I can't insert color into the black and white in PowerPoint. Can't do it. So here's the Sun, a main sequence star, and it's a G-type star. More precisely, the Sun is a G2 main sequence star. Betelgeuse, that other star I showed in the upper shoulder of the constellation of Orion, is an M star, so it appears super red. It's super cool, about 3,000 Kelvin. And yet it's an example of one of these supergiant stars. It lives up in this sort of horizontal supergiant shelf on the diagram. Rigel, the bright blue star in the foot of Orion, is in fact a B star. It's a B supergiant. It actually isn't on the main sequence. It's actually off the main sequence a bit. And it's up in this supergiant classification. Sirius, the dog star, the brightest star, in fact, in the night sky that we can see, and you can see it up on, if it ever gets clear around here, is in fact an A star. It's a main sequence star. In fact, it lies pretty well on top of that main sequence. Aldebaran is a bright K giant. It lives over here in the giant branch. Aldebaran is a really nice bright red star in the constellation of Boötes. It's a very easy one to see. In fact, it's a common navigational reference. And finally, Sirius, the dog star, if you look at it through a telescope under really good conditions, actually is a binary star. It has a companion, but that companion is one of these white dwarf stars. In fact, this one is just a little bit brighter than normal. It's a relatively recent arrival down here onto the white dwarfs, but it's one of these little tiny white dwarf stars. It was discovered telescopically in the late 19th century. So common stars within the winter sky, and of course our own Sun, know their places on the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. And I can take every star in the sky and tell you where they live. Now this distinction between dwarf, white dwarf, giant, supergiant needs to be shown in relative size, and that's what this diagram does. It takes those same stars. Here's our Sun, that little yellow dot, and these are all to scale. Sirius, an A main sequence star, is bigger, but now you can see why we've classified giants and supergiants. In fact, the supergiant here is bigger than the building on the scale. So we have the blue supergiants are able to fit on the screen. I just fit on the screen. Betelgeuse is so large, if we plopped it into our solar system, would fill our solar system out to the orbit of Jupiter, more than 5 astronomical units from the center. And then Sirius B, the white dwarf, I actually cannot represent it on this screen because it must be 1/100th of that little dude there that I've made for the Sun. And if you're sitting close enough, you can count there's only 10 pixels on this screen across that circle. So I can't draw a pixel small enough on these projectors to show you Sirius B, so I have to re-zoom the scale and put Sirius B alongside the Earth. Sirius B weighs as much as our Sun, which is a million times the mass of the Earth? Round numbers. A few hundred thousand times the mass of the Earth, but it's actually slightly smaller than the Earth. It's 5,800 kilometers versus 5,800 kilometers. They're about the same size. The Earth is about 6,000 kilometers in round numbers. So you can see these white dwarfs, there's something strange going on here. Well, it turns out, to get ahead of the story, the white dwarfs we're going to meet a little later this week are what stars like the Sun will end up as when they end their life. So they turn out to be the leftover cores of the inside of stars. This one's a little bit more massive. The Sun would be only about 4/10 the mass of the Sun, or 40%, 45% is the actual number for the prediction of the Sun's mass when it ends its life. So we have a tremendous gamut of stars, properties of luminosity, temperature, and masses. And we now need to understand, well, what's it look like around us? What's our neighborhood look like? And then ask, what are the life cycles of these stars like? And we put all that information together, we're going to be able to understand better how do we define the habitable zones around other stars than the Sun. Questions? Okay, I will see you all tomorrow then.